This is Pittsburgh Explainer from 90.5 WESA. Every Friday, we help you understand some of the most important news stories from southwestern Pennsylvania. It's Friday, July 24th. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Liz Reed. If you have kids, you're probably pretty stressed out right now. As the coronavirus pandemic drags on, many families still don't know what school will look like in the fall. Some parents are trying to figure out how to juggle working from home with remote learning. Others can't work from home, but have concerns about sending kids back into school buildings. While some districts are offering hybrid models with both online and in-person instruction, others haven't made up their minds yet, including Pittsburgh Public Schools. The PPS school year is scheduled to begin on August 31st. That's a little more than 5 weeks away, but it will be at least another week and a half before families know for sure what fall instruction is going to look like. Here to explain is WESA's education reporter, Sarah Schneider. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Liz.
Now, I thought the school board was supposed to vote on a reopening plan this week. What happened?
Yeah, so the board had intended to vote on the health and safety plan, and that's what's required for the state of Pennsylvania. So all districts in the state have to submit this plan saying how they're going to sanitize or who's going to be in charge when someone tests positive for COVID-19.
So this is just one part of the reopening plan that they were going to vote on.
Correct. Yes. And so they were set to vote on that at the July legislative meeting, and that has been pushed back a week. We did get an early presentation of this plan, and a lot of that came from the feedback from this all-in to open schools committee. There were like 14 subcommittees that worked on this. So that's what was supposed to happen this week.
And 400 recommendations, I think, is worth noting.
Right. Yeah, 400 recommendations. And it's, I mean, everything from classroom learning to transportation to cafeteria eating, those kinds of things. That was supposed to be in the health and safety plan. August 4th, that larger detailed plan that will be voted on. Also, at that August 4th meeting, the board will vote on a resolution that was proposed this week from board member Kevin Carter, and he's suggesting that schools remain online for the first 9 weeks. That's the first quarter of the year. And the board did not vote on that at this week's meeting, instead decided to push that back. But there seem to be several board members that are considering this. They think this is a good idea because they're saying, you know, 9 weeks will give us a lot more time to plan, and cases are increasing in the region, so this might be the safest option. So that will also be voted on at the August 4th meeting.
Part of the reason they're waiting, I understand, is because there's a public hearing scheduled for the week prior, right?
So that was scheduled because of this proposal. And so to give the community and parents time to give feedback to the board on this resolution. So the plan to stay online for the first 9 weeks.
And when's that public hearing?
That is July 29th at 5:00.
There were a lot of issues with the district's rollout of online learning in the spring. What assurances do we have that things will go more smoothly in the fall if kids do end up learning remotely?
Short answer is we don't have assurances yet. Until this full plan is released, we know what the district intends to do. You know, there were some administrators at this week's meeting who said if we move to full remote learning, there will be a lot of professional development for teachers. The district seems pretty sure that it will have enough technology for kids. That was a real issue in the spring, not just for Pittsburgh Public, but across the country. Districts that are in wealthier areas had the technology to loan to students so that they could move online quickly, and Pittsburgh Public did not have that. You know, the district waited 2 weeks after schools closed to even survey parents on what the needs were, and so there was a lot of criticism of the district for that and the slow move to get more technology. But now they say they are prepared, and every student will have a device in the fall, in a month, I guess, and that was a huge hurdle. And so if they have that, that's an assurance that at least kids will be equipped. But then there's internet, and a lot of things have changed since March. You know, more people are out of work, and so internet might not be something that they can afford. And How is the district going to equip families with that? There are a lot of unanswered questions still.
What about kids with special needs, like students with individualized education plans, students with learning differences or cognitive disabilities? Like, how is the district going to make sure they get the education that they are legally entitled to?
Kevin Carter, in this proposal to delay in-person learning for 9 weeks, one of the requirements, if this is approved, is that the district prepare a, quote, you know, contingency plan for students with disabilities, students who have IEPs, that's an individualized education plan. And as you said, it guarantees students services. And across the country, not a lot of school districts are doing this well. These inequities that existed before the pandemic are definitely being exacerbated, and that is true for students with disabilities. Pam Harbin is a school board member who's been a longtime advocate for students with disabilities, and she said at this most recent school board meeting that if we're going to do this, if we're going to delay in-person learning, you know, the system was not set up for this, so rebuild it, right? And she said this is the time to disrupt the system, and the district needs to think critically about how it can creatively give these, you know, resources and make sure that students with disabilities have everything they need to have an equitable education remotely, which is going to be really challenging. So, and again, they have a month to do that.
It's going to be a very interesting fall, and I'm sure you will be very busy this fall as we see how education starts to play out. Thanks so much for being on the show this week.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks, Liz.
It's time for a quick break. We'll be right back.
I'm Dave Isay of StoryCorps. For years, we've connected loved ones through meaningful conversation. At this moment of profound political polarization, we're trying something new. It's called One Small Step. You come to StoryCorps to meet a stranger from across the political divides, not to talk about politics, but to get to know their story. It's an effort to help remind us that we're all just human beings. And WESA is helping lead our effort in Pennsylvania right now. Sign up at WESA.fm.
This week, the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority closed what Executive Director Will Pickering called, quote, an unfortunate chapter in the agency's history. Compliance testing showed that lead levels in drinking water were once again below the federal action level of 15 parts per billion. PWSA first exceeded this level in 2016, kicking off a wave of changes, including thousands of lead service line replacements, a more efficient testing program, and shakeups among leadership. Here to explain more about how we got here is development and transportation reporter Margaret J. Krause. Hello, Margaret.
Hello, Liz.
To what are PWSA officials crediting this drop in lead levels?
They're largely crediting it to the addition of something called orthophosphate, which is a water treatment that they began to add to the drinking water in April of last year of 2019. And what it does is it forms this barrier on the inside of the pipes so that the water doesn't actually touch older lead and copper pipes, and it just instead touches this barrier, this chemical barrier of orthophosphate. And so what they're saying is we can protect the most number of people this way across the system, even while we continue this aggressive program of lead line removal throughout the system.
Now, back in 2016, when this lead crisis first came to light, I was WESA's health and science reporter, as you'll recall. And I remember covering this meeting in Lawrenceville with then executive director Bernard Lindstrom and director of engineering Bob Weimar, who later became the executive director and recently retired. And people at this meeting were so mad. The customer testing program to figure out your lead levels, like in your house, was in complete chaos. There were problems with billing and customer service. PWSA was the authority that everybody loved to hate. People really had nothing good to say about it. And I found Lindstrom at that meeting to be quite defensive and somewhat dismissive of people's concerns. How has leadership changed since 2016?
I mean, so colloquially, I think you and I have discussed how PWSA had this come to Jesus moment. And there were a lot of factors involved with that. One of them is that the city applied a lot of pressure. There was a board shakeup, and the board really took the reins and said, like, we're going to cop to every problem that we have. We're going to lay out what it is, and we're going to fix it. There was also this external process ongoing where the mayor appointed this quote-unquote blue ribbon panel, which was basically to dig into PWSA's operations and point out all the problems, which is what PWSA undertook as well. To your point, they kind of cleaned house. For years, PWSA was kind of a place where politicians would put their friends or like their nephew who needed a job. The infrastructure was doing great. It was fine. It was still providing clean water. And so nothing was really invested there for the longest time. Rates didn't go up to modernize the system or to, you know, provide more redundancy in the system. And then basically it was a huge pileup of problems because it had been neglected and just used as an outpost for like whatever people wanted at the time. And so this explosion in 2016 was a long time coming. And they appointed Bob Weimar as interim executive director. And Bob Weimar is just kind of this no-nonsense guy whose whole ethos as a human seems to be, what is the problem? What is the correct solution? How do we get there? And let's appreciate the people who help us get there.
Margaret, I need you to tell the listeners Bob Weimar's like personal motto. Without cursing.
Yeah, this I found so charming. Bob Weimar had hats made that said GSD, which stands for Get Stuff Done. You can substitute your own S word in there, you know, depending on your feelings. And that was really the mentality that he brought to PWSA, which was, we are charged with giving our customers clean water safely, efficiently, solve problems that they have. And hopefully, like, the ideal of a utility is to just never be on anyone's radar because it's working so well, you don't think about it. And for a long time, that was not the case with PWSA. Too many people were thinking about it. I'm sure that there is more to be done. And in fact, Will Pickering has said there is more to be done. They acknowledge that the public lost faith in PWSA, and that's not something that they took lightly, and they acknowledge that there's a lot of work to be done to ensure that people look to PWSA and see an agency that is working in their best interests and is accessible and is going to do what needs to be done in order to continue to provide clean, safe drinking water for the foreseeable future.
I think it's also worth mentioning that PWSA recently reached a settlement with State Attorney General Josh Shapiro related to the lead crisis. What happened there?
In 2016, when PWSA exceeded that lead action level, it set off alarm bells in all sorts of places. And the first place it set off an alarm bell is with the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. So, you know, they have to get together and be like, this is a problem. Here's what you're going to do to fix it. And PWSA has to say, okay, that's what we'll do. We'll fix it. They sign a piece of paper. And they had to begin replacing lead lines. So a service line runs from the water main in the street to something called a curb box, which is at the curb. And that section is publicly owned and operated. And then from the curb box to someone's house, that's the privately owned side. So at the time, PWSA didn't think that they could replace that private side under state law. And so they were doing partial lead line replacements, digging up that public section, replacing it with something that's not lead, and then leaving the private side. And so unintentionally, they say, they were violating the Safe Drinking Water Act. Even though DEP told them to do this,
because that method sort of rustles up the lead in the still lead private side of the line, right?
Right, right. So you basically, you bust open this line and you break loose a lot of this, of the metal that just is like suddenly now in the system. It's in the distribution system. And it, more importantly, higher in this person's home, probably. And so despite the fact that these very same problems, PWSA was negotiating with DEP saying like, oh, maybe this is a bad idea. Can we do it this way? Can we do it that way? Working with state representatives to try and work on the private side of the line. The state said like, whoa, that's also a criminal violation. So DEP is a civil situation. And Attorney General Josh Shapiro's office said, this is also a criminal violation. And so we are going to take you to task on that side of things. And the settlement that they agreed to was to take $500,000 to split between two organizations to help protect Pittsburghers from lead contamination. And they're also hiring an independent corporate monitor. They're accepting another layer of oversight just to make sure that they're doing everything totally above board for all of the agencies that look at PWSA.
Margaret, thanks so much for your reporting and for being on the show this week.
Thank you, Liz Reed.
It's time for another break. Stay with us.
Are you a Pittsburgh musician waiting to be discovered? Have you been using quarantine to hone your talent and create new work? Well, don't miss your opportunity to sign up for the WYEP Singer-Songwriter Competition. August 7th is the deadline to submit your name before we draw our first round of artists. To register for your chance to perform, visit WYEP.org/singer-songwriter2020.
When Pittsburgh voters go to the polls in November, they'll decide whether the city's Citizen Police Review Board should have the power to compel officers to participate in its investigations of alleged police misconduct. The measure was sponsored by City Councilor Ricky Burgess and received final approval from council this week. Here with more about what exactly is being asked of voters is government and accountability reporter Ariel Worthy. Ariel, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Can you just start by explaining what the Citizen Police Review Board is and how things currently work?
Yeah, so the Citizen Police Review Board, they're actually an independent board, and they investigate complaints against police officers. The board, basically, they determine whether or not it is a valid complaint, and if it is, they move forward with investigating it. And then they can have a hearing, and they can bring in the officer. So basically, an officer, they are subpoenaed to appear. And currently, the way it works is an officer has every right to assert their Fifth Amendment rights if they're going to say something or if they're asked a question and the answer could potentially incriminate them. So they don't have to answer those questions. But questions like, you know, were you working at 4 p.m. on Friday? Questions like that. Currently, if they don't answer them, they face very minor consequences. It's written up as misconduct, but like the way I asked the executive director of the board, I was like, so if an officer doesn't answer these questions, these very basic questions, are they suspended or anything? And she was like, it's more like an oral reprimand. So it's not even really a written reprimand. It's very, very small consequences if they're not participating or cooperating with an investigation.
Would this referendum actually increase the penalties for officers, or does it just make it easier to implement those penalties?
Yeah, so now officers actually could face termination. They could actually lose their jobs if they're not going to cooperate or participate.
If this passes.
Yes, if this passes, yes. So the board, they actually felt that this was something that actually gave them more power, because oftentimes if an officer is not participating or cooperating and they're not getting much discipline for it, it kind of felt that sometimes they could they couldn't really investigate something properly.
So it sounds like what the voters are being asked is, should the board actually have more teeth if officers refuse to answer questions that wouldn't be self-incriminating or just are being difficult and refusing to participate? Should they face actual consequences?
Yeah, correct. So, and another change would actually be, so currently the Office of Municipal Investigations, they're also part of the city, and they also do their own investigations. So they might also look at the same complaint against an officer. However, usually they kind of render their own verdicts and they kind of make their own decisions on if the officer was actually doing anything wrong or if there was actually any misconduct taking place. And this is kind of where the review board and OMI, they might disagree. Often OMI, they might have their recommendations for discipline out before the review board does. And sometimes the police chief could make discipline decisions based on OMI's findings versus the review board's findings. So another change for this bill actually would be that they would have to wait until after the review board is done with their investigations to render any kind of discipline or anything against an officer.
Now, the last time there was a police-related referendum on the ballot was in 2015. It said that officers had to live within Pittsburgh city limits. That actually passed, but was later struck down in court because of the police union's contract. And the police union is very strong in Pittsburgh, and as they are across the country. Could the same thing happen again with this proposal?
So I spoke with Councilor Ricky Burgess, who introduced the legislation, and he was saying this is different because, for one, the legislation that required the officers to live within city limits, that kind of got into a weird state territory where, you know, making those kinds of requirements for officers kind of overstepped the boundaries of the city's powers. So this is basically making a change to the Home Rule Charter, which is basically kind of like the city's constitution. So it's basically the city making changes to a board that's already under city power in a way. Even though they are independent, they're still under the city. So this is not the same thing, because this would only be for the city of Pittsburgh. It's not going to be something that would maybe have like wider consequences outside of the city of Pittsburgh.
I imagine that the campaigning on both sides of this issue will begin very soon in earnest. It'll be interesting to see how this debate plays out in the lead up to November. Thanks so much for your reporting.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That's Pittsburgh Explainer for this week. Our show is produced by Katie Blackley. Christopher Ayers is our editor. You can find all of our news coverage at our website, WESA.FM, and of course on the air at 90.5 FM. I'm your host, Liz Reed. Thanks for listening. Let's talk next week.